How many times have you thought, I don't see my friends enough, and I'd really like to volunteer somewhere, but between working and the kids and the house, I just can't fit it in? Dr. Edward Hollowell says the frenetic pace of today's world may be detracting from the meaningfulness of our lives. In his new book, Connect, he argues that the single most important key to emotional well-being is to connect with something larger than yourself, such as relationships with family and friends, contributions to the community, a belief system, or nature. Dr. Hollowell is a practicing psychiatrist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. His earlier books are Driven to Distraction, a 1994 bestseller about attention deficit disorder, and a book about worrying. In his new book, he writes of how connections helped him through a difficult childhood.
They saved my life. Connections meant everything to me, and I suppose that's the driving force behind my writing the book. Not only have I seen as a professional the transforming power of connection, but long before I ever heard of medical school, I was transformed, saved, rescued by connections. I come from an old New England WASP family characterized by what I call the WASP triad, which is mental illness, alcoholism, and politeness. And so most people in my family tree were touched by two or three of those qualities. I lost my mom and dad divorced when I was 4 years old because my father became psychotic and was put in a state mental hospital. And my mother then remarried an alcoholic person who was alcoholic and abusive and carted us off to South Carolina. So I was in this crucible of craziness and drunkenness and abuse. And it was not a good place for a little boy to be. And I, at that point, got sent off to boarding school in the fifth grade at the age of 10. And that really saved me. Even before then, finding healthy parents in the homes of my friends, singing in the little choir that I sang in at St. Michael's Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And through those connections, my life was saved.
Your stepfather, I think you called him Uncle
right.
Noble, right?
Right.
Was he physical drunk? Was he physically abusive?
Yeah, he would get drunk and beat up my mother, and then I would try to intervene, and he would knock me around.
Well, what was your coping mechanism as a kid?
I fought with Uncle Noble while I was there. I fought with him. I stood up to him. And, you know, he put me down, of course, because he was bigger. But I used spunk. I used my verbal skills. Because I was sober and he was drunk, I could dodge around him. I covered over the sadness, I guess, like a lot of little boys. I cried in my pillow sometimes. But then I would find other people.
Did you still have meaningful contact with your mother and stepfather after you went to school?
Well, it was very estranged with my stepfather. By then, I pretty much hated him, and he pretty much hated me. But and then, not long after that, my mom divorced him, and I lost contact with him. I called him up after I'd finished medical school and was selling my first book and told him what I'd done, and he disbelieved me. He said, I won't say on the air the words he used, but he said that was impossible, that I could never have done anything like that. And I remember feeling to myself so vindicated that I had done more in my life for other people and had achieved more than that man could ever possibly have done. It was a moment of vindication for me, because when I was a little boy, of course, there was a part of me that thought maybe he's right.
It's interesting in the context of discussing connecting more deeply to one's past. You talk about a trip you took back to South Carolina, back to Charleston, to your childhood home, and this is after you've been married. You were in your second marriage. You had three kids. You're fully right. Established adult, and you went to see the house you grew up in. What were you looking for?
ghosts, I guess. It was eerie. I guess I was looking to master the bad things that had happened. There's something about the concrete, you know, walking back into those rooms where I had watched those drunken fights, where I'd watched my stepfather pick up the poker and swing it at my mother, where I had tried to tackle him around the knees, where I had watched the Christmas turkey get dumped on the floor and been told to clean it up. To walk through those rooms and now see that it wasn't there anymore, that it was gone, that it was over, that I had grown up and that I had children I loved and that I had friends that I loved and that I had a job I could do, that people valued me. I went back to Charleston because they wanted to have me come down and lecture. They knew nothing of my past there. That it was over. And at the same time, that I didn't have to amputate my past, that I could still say and even write about it and talk about it now with you, that it's okay to have had a horrible past and still integrate it into who you are now. And in a sense, I'm the stronger for it. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but having survived it and having lived through it, I feel equipped and able to help others do the same, that it's a bearable problem.
Does it change the emotions that you carry with you from childhood, this act of, I guess, taking of closure and of reconnecting?
Very much so. It detoxifies it. People say you can't change and trauma cannot be undone. Well, the events can't be undone. But I tell you how I feel about it now. It's detoxified. It's like it's been, you know, the Boston Harbor has been depolluted. I mean, it's like my memories have had the pollution taken out of them. The toxicity, the evilness of it seems to have been taken out.
My guest is Edward Hollowell. He's a practicing psychiatrist. He teaches at Harvard Medical School, and he has a new book about establishing a deeper engagement with friends, with your work, with life. It's called Connect. You wrote your first book of two about attention deficit disorder back in 1994. And there's been an ongoing debate about Ritalin and the rise of psychotropic drugs and the treatment of children and overdiagnosis of ADD in the last 5 years. It's been a roiling topic of controversy. Has your thinking about ADD evolved since you wrote the book?
Oh, very much so. It's in keeping with what I was saying about sort of being a messenger. The general public is behind the brain science when it comes to most topics related to the brain, and attention deficit disorder being just one. We get caught up in controversy before we know the facts. And so a lot of people are arguing about it without really knowing the facts. The facts are a really good news story that we now are able to help children and adults who struggle with this condition and change their lives very much for the better. I truly have a stack of letters in my office, people who've written to me who I've never met, saying how the diagnosis and treatment of this condition changed their lives for the better. Now, that is not to say we should all run out and think that ADD and the medications used to treat ADD are you know, the panacea. They're certainly not. But just as depression sort of came out of a period of tremendous misunderstanding and now is accepted by most people as a real condition with a real treatment, so attention deficit disorder has gone through a period of tremendous misunderstanding and hopefully will come to a place where people realize it's a real condition with a real treatment and can help a lot of children and adults lead much better lives.
I'm thinking of a new research study I just read about that is going on in Britain, which apparently has a very low rate of ADD diagnoses. Scientists there studied two groups of kids, observed them. One group was diagnosed with ADD and one group was not. And the result was that there was no measurable difference in their behavior under observation. And one conclusion that you could draw is that it's a matter of what kind of behavior our society is willing to tolerate that we are we have a higher rate of ADD in this country, or it's a matter of what the psychiatric community tolerates or is looking for, perhaps. And all these questions, I suppose, are raised by this study. I'm curious what your comments are.
Well, those are all very interesting observations, and it is certainly true that cultural norms have a lot to do with what we consider normal when we make a diagnosis. But if anything, I think the American cultural norm is more permissive than the average British school norm. If anything, I think our gene pool is more on the rambunctious side than the British. But where I get where I come down is as a clinician and less as a theorizer or an academician. And I can just tell you, I see people in my office every week whose lives are deeply impaired because of the way their brain is wired, whether it's a child or an adult. And if the diagnosis happens to be attention deficit disorder, which is just a collection of symptoms, if their symptoms fit that description, I also see in my office every week these lives change dramatically for the better. So it's not a matter of, you know, oh, my saying Tom Sawyer really needs a little Ritalin to make him less Tom Sawyer-like. It's a matter of saying this eighth grader or this 40-year-old man who is got tremendous potential and who is vastly underachieving, when given the right diagnosis and the right treatment, suddenly can start focus and achieving and mastering his or her world. That's well beyond, you know, are we overdiagnosing Tom Sawyer? I think the debates are more of theoretical interest. The practical concern, believe me, as a clinician, is just very, very clear. When this diagnosis is made properly, this is not a hair-splitting issue. This is a life-saving diagnosis and treatment.
Edward Hollowell is my guest. He's a practicing psychiatrist and a senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Connect. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Dr. Edward Hollowell. His new book is Connect. He's also the author of Driven to Distraction, about attention deficit disorder. Now, you had ADD, or have it.
I have ADD.
You have
it,
right?
Yep, I have it. I have it. And I've never required treatment for it. When I was growing up, nobody had ever heard of this condition. You know, when I was a kid, the diagnoses were good and bad and smart and stupid. And the treatment plan was to shame, pain, and humiliation, or try harder. I mean, those were the diagnoses and the treatments that we had. I was very lucky. As I said, I got sent away to boarding schools, small schools that were highly structured. I had teachers who drew out the best in me. I was very lucky. My ADD is mild. I don't have the particularly hyperactive, disruptive kind of ADD.
So how does it manifest itself?
Well, in my life, it manifests with a mind that's all over the place. And what I try to do is turn it into an asset. I try to, you know, the keys in managing ADD are probably the keys in managing adult life in general. Marry the right person and find the right job. And I married this wonderful woman who loves me for who I am instead of trying to turn me into someone who I'm not. And I'm lucky enough to have a job where I can do many different activities. I'm my own boss. I can write books, give lectures, and see patients. So I have tremendous variety. And so I'm able to take advantage of the upside of my ADD and not be severely penalized by the downside. Now, I want to emphasize that in talking about myself, I'm not talking about the typical person with attention deficit disorder. The typical person with attention deficit disorder, be it a child or an adult, is underachieving, is frustrated, is having trouble both socially and academically, but is just one diagnosis and treatment away from a much better life. Not nirvana, but a much better life. And the analogy I like to use, it's very akin to someone who is nearsighted, who hasn't discovered eyeglasses. And when you give them eyeglasses, suddenly they can make use of the brain they've got instead of seeing everything as a blur. They still have to work hard. It's not an excuse. They still have to take responsibility for their actions. But once you give them the eyeglasses, they're able to make use of the talents they have instead of being constantly frustrated at how hard it is to see straight.
There's an interesting progression, I'm thinking, in the work that you've done, and especially in the books that you've written. You wrote these two books about ADD. It's a very specific disorder. You wrote about learning and emotional problems in childhood. Then you had a book about worry, and apparently you're a big worrier, which is also a very specific activity that can be both healthy and dysfunctional. And Now you have a theory of engagement, connectedness, which is really pretty amorphous. It's about leading a good life. It's as if you're, maybe you should identify the meaningful development here, but you're straying a little bit out of the territory of psychiatry.
Oh, sure. What I try to do is speak from my brain and my heart to other people in such a way that they can lead better lives. I mean, I do write of what I know, both personally as well as professionally. My friend Alan Brown, another psychiatrist, said to me, "Ned, when are you going to run out of personal problems that you can write books about?" And I told him that the store is endless. I don't have to worry about running out. But I try to take what I know and what I've seen, both as a professional and as a person, and bring it to the level where it can ease people's pain, where it can make life better. And what is exciting to me is that we have practical tools for doing that now. We have practical tools. I lost my father to manic depressive illness. My parents got divorced because of that condition. If he had received the right treatment and the right diagnosis when I was 4 years old, they would not have gotten divorced. And it was a very sad thing for me to see him pack his bags and leave home. That didn't have to happen. And today, now, there are truly hundreds of thousands of children and adults in this country who are one diagnosis away from a much better life, their families, their own lives, in the work site. Whether you're talking about manic depressive illness or ADD or depression or simple unhappiness in everyday life, and that's not a diagnosis, but that's a state that we really do have effective remedies for. And in the books, I outline the ones where you don't have to see a professional, like connecting, like keeping up with your friends, like eating family dinner, like raising a garden or having a pet. And I also talk about the professional interventions, which are equally simple and practical and now tested from specific forms of psychotherapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy, to the newer generation of medications, the serotonin active medications, the stimulant medications that are also safe and effective when they're used properly.
Edward Hollowell, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. Edward Hollowell's new book is Connect. He heads the Hollowell Center for Cognitive and Emotional Health in Concord, Massachusetts.